Welcome to The Bazness, one-on-one conversations with fascinating artists. I'm your host, Sam Landman. Tonight, we're speaking with someone who, this is me, defines a working actor, a working performer.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have to say actor. We can say performer, just make it more general.
Person in the arts.
Person in the arts. A working artist,
mm-hmm.
which is what a lot of people strive to do,
mm-hmm.
and that's awesome, yet a lot of us, 90-something percent of us, probably go through our lives with relatives, spouses, whatever, going, yeah, that's all good, but, you know, you have a day job, or when you get back from play practice, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know what to say. This is the complete and utter definition of working artist. It is Greta Grosch. Greta, thank you for being here.
Thank you. It is a thrill.
Yes,
and it's
awesome.
Thank you for saying all of that, because I recently had a birthday,
mm-hmm.
and in the few years before that, I was having sort of this crisis of identity, and I thought, who am I, and what, because as you said, I do so many things, what should I pursue? Like, if I just picked one thing, would I be really successful at the one thing? And if I just picked a lane, stay in my lane, and they're like, what are you talking about? You're living the dream.
Yeah.
Because I am making a living in this business and doing a lot of things. So if one thing isn't working out, there's always another thing to do. So, but it's that when you're in it, you don't necessarily pay attention to all the opportunities that you are pursuing because you're so busy looking for the next one. So,
but you're moving forward on that highway. Picking a lane or not, at least you're moving. There's a forward momentum there.
Right. And so some people are in like a narrow road and they're going fast and straight. And it's, you know, it's, and I am going on a like 35W going north. It's a very wide, like 6-lane highway.
Yeah.
And I'm plowing forward in my life, in my career. So, yeah, but it's working. And like I said, somebody looked at me and we're like, what are you talking about? It is what you're doing is working. So stop complaining.
But it is that, okay, what have I done so far? I am a certain age.
Mm-hmm.
It's not even an existential crisis. It's more of a professional crisis of like, well, where do I go? And we'll get to this because we're going to, that's some of the stuff I want to delve into a little bit.
Yeah.
Some of that existential stuff where, what am I doing?
Well,
where
and I thought I about this because, you know, the McKnight Foundation, they give these grants. And I thought, great opportunity. I've been doing this a long time. I know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
I should apply for a grant. And but they really do need you to pick a lane.
Yeah.
Like you have to, I'm an actor or I'm a playwright or I'm a director. So I went to this informational meeting and even the woman who was running it, she goes, well, I think of you as an actor. And I said, but what about, don't you have something for like the person who just supports the arts in Minnesota? Like I've devoted my whole life. And she goes, that's not really how this works.
Do you have a smorgasbord program?
Yeah.
Like just a whatever.
Yeah.
It's like,
it's Minnesota. We should totally
have.
But then I was telling this other friend of mine about that, and he said, well, then the McKnight is not for you. There are other grants that are for people like you, like a Bush Fellowship or something.
Or Jerome. I don't know if Jerome might go the same route as McKnight, though. They might be like,
well,
you got to be an artist. You got to be a
playwright or whatever that is.
Yeah,
and I was like,
it's playwrights.
Anyway,
right,
but as you said, we're putting the cart before the horse because—
Yes.
We've jumped so far into the story. This is the trick. I tell people, like, if you're writing, because you're going to eventually tell people that I'm a writer, you have to jump into the middle of the story.
Right.
So that's what we did. We didn't spend a lot of time on exposition. We just jumped right into the middle
of
the story.
But I love that because it's like a novel. It's like, it's not a movie where it has to be in a certain order. We're jumping around. We're picking and choosing. I'm going to get to the writing in a second. But as a performer...
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a specific process in terms of, I know every performance, every play, every whatever is different, but do you have a process that you go through as an actor that's just a tried and true thing?
Well, it's changed, that is for sure.
Okay.
And it's changed over the years as I've gotten to know myself better.
Yeah.
And it used to be that when I started, I needed to know what I was going to wear, what my shoes were like. I needed to know what the character looked like because I had to attach myself to that because I had to become somebody else. And now I've been doing this for a long time, so my process is different. And now it's about the text. I dive into the text first. I have to understand the thought process of the character, what it is they're saying and what they want, etc. And I was recently working on a monologue. After all these years, I've gone back to the classroom. I'm taking an acting class again.
What?
I know, it's really fun. And so I was working on a monologue, and I was having a really hard time memorizing it. And I said, the reason I'm not memorizing it is because I haven't attached myself to the text and to who the character is and what they need. And it's true, even I do lots of voiceovers. And when I'm in the recording booth, you don't always have time to figure out what you're saying because you've got 6 pages of text and an hour to do it.
Right.
But once, if I know what I'm talking about, I'm better and I can emotionally attach to it. So my process now as an actor is to, and some of this is because I've become a writer, I really honor the words. So I really want to dive into what the writer was trying to communicate, and I can get in, that's my entry point into the character that way, is to figure out what the story is that needs to be told and how can I serve the story.
Wow.
So it's a different process because it used to be that I wanted to put the story on.
Yeah.
And now I want to get into the story. And I don't know when that happened, but I definitely know that that's the first thing I do is I sit there and I'm really eager to get it memorized so that I can then start to make it my own that way. But that's my process is text first.
That's a great answer.
So
that's one question. No, we have, so we were talking about mainly as a performer and delving into, you mentioned a writer earlier, but so you was your initial start at Brave New Workshop where, or did you go to school for something else before Brave New Workshop, or was that sort of your education?
I got a degree in theater. I started off as a math major. I was going to be a math teacher. So although I had done theater and performing my whole life, I didn't know anybody who did this as a business. I didn't know you could do it as a business. You know, I knew you sing in choir at church and maybe you're in a community choir and, you know, you might do community theater, but I didn't know that this was an option.
Yeah.
So then I got my degree in theater because, you know, math classes start at 8 and theater classes start at 10, thinking that eventually you have to get a graduate degree to do anything anyway.
Right.
But then I moved to New York. I toured and did a lot of regional theater, and I was just sort of doing the non-union circuit. And I did that through my 20s. And then I came back at the end of my 20s, and that's when I auditioned at the Brave New Workshop and was cast. And then that's really then when my life sort of took a turn.
How long were you there, like off and on, or is it...
I was there for a year.
Okay.
So for... And that our company worked together for a year, and then I moved on and did other things.
What were the other things? What'd you move on to do? You just did something along the same lines, or you decided, I'm just going to keep auditioning as an actor?
Well, the reason I left, I left the workshop because I had another opportunity in New York. And this is interesting, because do you know who Melissa Peterman is?
Yes,
so,
of course.
I left the workshop, and I was going to go do this other thing. And so they hired Melissa Peterman to come and take my spot. And Melissa had been doing Tony and Tina's Wedding. So Tony and Tina's Wedding called me and asked me to take Melissa's spot. And so we literally swapped within like a week of each other. So I returned down this other job and I took Tony and Tina's Wedding. So this was in June of that year, 96 or whatever year it was. Right. And we just literally swapped places.
Oh, that's so funny.
It was so funny. And then, and there's that tricky thing when you go, I look at her life and what happened with her life. You know, and they then, as a result of that, went to LA and they had a showcase and all of this. And my life has gone my way.
Yeah.
And there are those moments when you go, if I would have stayed at the workshop, it does not mean that my life would have been Melissa's life. Because my life went the direction that my life was meant to go, and her life went the direction it was meant to go.
True.
And those are those tricky moments when the actor in me rears its ugly head and you want to go, stop it.
Yeah.
Stop being that person who don't begrudge somebody else the success when you have your own kind of, it's a really tricky thing.
See, I was going to bring that up in the intro because the reason I do a lot of things these days as a performer, as a writer, whatever, is I want to say jealousy, but sometimes, well, it's another ugly sort of feeling, which is you're envious of someone. Oh, they did that? I can do that. I could write plays. I could do blah, 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 blah. I don't know if there are a lot of people out there thinking, well, that's not necessarily the reason I do it, but I'm sure there are a lot of people going, oh, man, I did this show with them and they did this.
Yeah.
But my career just went a different trajectory. I mean.
Right. And there is that thing, because I've had this recently, where you can be envious of somebody else But again, I know then there are people that are envious of me.
Right.
So, but and there are a couple, and there are always people that I really like. And you know what? I've been cheerleading them from the beginning.
Yeah.
And then I go and I see, and they're doing the things that I would love to do. Mm. And I would go, I would love to do that someday. But then you have to remind yourself, it's not over. Right. I mean, I can do what I'm doing for 40 more years.
Yeah. Yeah.
My relatives live well into their 90s. So, so a little bit of envy is, I think, natural and human and maybe good for you because what's the opposite? Complacency? I don't know.
It's, right.
But and there is that tricky thing, like, what's the difference between jealousy and envy?
Yeah.
Because it's not that I wish them harm.
No. No.
But I sure would like that, too.
Right. I mean, I wish them harm. You don't. Let's be clear. So with Brave New Workshop, how did that shape you as a performer? Did that immediately sharpen those skills you already had? Or is that something that just evolved out of performing with Brave New Workshop?
So Brave New Workshop, and I don't know how it's evolved now, but really a writer's workshop, writer improv workshop. And so that's where, up until then, the only writing I'd done was these comedy songs. I was, as I mentioned, I'd been touring, and I bought myself a guitar. And the way I would teach myself to play is I would make up a funny song using the chords I was learning.
Yeah.
The very first song I wrote was, I've got to get me some ugly friends. So, and so I went to the audition, and they wanted us to bring some writing samples, and all I had were these funny songs. Dudley Riggs was still there. It was still Dudley Riggs. I was there during the transition time. And they were like, that's great. That's fine. Hmm. And so it's that thing where I didn't know what I didn't know, so I came into it as I was with my funny songs.
Yeah.
And the reason I was cast was because Anna Branvik was in the cast. And at my audition, we did a musical improv, and I had no idea what I was doing. Mm. I didn't even really know her very well.
Wow.
But I had been musically improvising my entire life because my mother is very musical, and my mom, my sister, and I would musically improv.
Uh-huh.
So I remember that moment because I was just looking at Anna and just making up a song with her.
Oh, man.
Because I didn't know what I didn't know. So that's what was my entry point to the workshop. But then you start to realize what you don't know, and then you start to question yourself. So from that point on, I constantly question my improvisational skills.
Yeah.
Because now I know that there are guidelines, there are rules, there's technique, as opposed to it's not just play like it was at that. So I have never been as good as I was at that audition on that day. I remember it so clearly. And there was one scene, we were going to do a scene, and it looked like we had to be a mountain climber. And I turned to the guy who was in the scene, and I go, who do you want to be? And he goes, let's just see how it goes. And I went, what? Oh, okay, I get it. It's just play.
Right.
That's what this is.
Yeah.
But that definitely shaped me as a writer because that's when I learned how to take ideas and to write them down and then cut them and then cut them again and then cut them again. And I remember I wrote one sketch that was like 7 pages long and it ended up as a 30-second blackout. And you have to be okay with that.
Sure.
Because you want to get to what's best. And so that was a lesson that I'm constantly learning, whether I'm acting, you know, you're doing a bit and the director's like, bring it down, bring it down.
Right.
You want to get to the heart of what's best. And that's true when you're performing and you're writing. And I definitely learned that at the workshop.
Wow. Okay. So that's a great segue into your writing. So I went to GretaGrosch.com and I found, I don't even, holy F, where do we start with your writing projects and the things you've done up to this point? Not just working on soon. Give me a little bit of a dive into, were you cast in the original Church Basement Ladies initially and then wrote sequels?
Yes.
Or were you in the writing process of the original?
No, the original one, there was a different team and I was one of the original cast. And because it's an original show, we were workshopping it a lot.
Sure.
And I have, as I mentioned, I like math. I was going to be a math teacher. So I have a very linear, logical brain.
Hmm.
So as we were working through all this stuff, I was able to keep track of it and to organize it. So we would go and we'd work on something and then Kurt Wallen, my boss, he'd go like, what just happened? And I went, okay. So, and then I was able to just chronologically just list out what was able to happen. I'm able to organize information.
Wow.
That's an ability of mine. So throughout that process, people were like, you should write the sequel. We hadn't even opened yet. And so then eventually we opened, the show ran, it was a huge hit. And then that next spring, Kurt also produces this thing called the Medora Musical in Medora, North Dakota. And he brought me on as the writer for that. And I think he was sort of auditioning me to see how that went. And he told me he liked me because I didn't cry. And I was like, great.
You didn't cry when he gave you notes about stuff?
He said, you're the first writer I've ever worked with who doesn't cry. And that, by the way, is in my head all the time. Now, I've been working with him for 14 years, and when I'm like, don't cry, don't cry, don't cry, because it's an emotional thing. Then after that, that went well. And so then he asked me if I would write the sequel. So then that would be Church Basement Ladies 2. And so I sat down with him, and I said, well, this is what I think we should do. And I laid out a total of 5, so 4 additional shows.
Okay.
So I ended up then, when I sat and talked with him, I already thought about how this could become a whole series. So, you know, in terms of like how we organized the information and jumping back in time and forward in time. And so then I wrote up to number 5, which we called The Last Potluck Supper, thinking that it would be the end. And then the audience clamored for more. So then we did a number 6, and I said, if we're going to move forward, we need to sort of shift around a little bit. It's like when Frasier left Cheers.
Yeah.
He was the same character, but they sort of shifted a little bit. So that CBL 6 went, Church Basement Ladies 6 went really well. These shows have been produced in 48 states and Canada, really successful. Now we're done. And then now we're doing number 7, Church Basement Ladies 7. It opens in September.
Oh, my God.
And people are already lining up for it. You know?
Yeah.
So the shows, they get licensed at theaters around the country, and they go on tours and things. And so it's pretty crazy.
Amazing. Because Kurt, before that, the only reason I know about Troop America, Kurt, at that time with Troop America, is because I did the last tour of How to Talk Minnesotan.
Oh, yeah.
So I memorized 5 shows, all the 4 seasons and the Christmas version.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, I thought that was a lot. And now, and those were kind of sort of sequels, but these are honest to God legit sequels.
Sequels and prequels, yeah.
And prequels.
So the show, the original one, it was 5 members of the cast in this small rural church basement. And so then we did the first show, and then the second one was a direct sequel.
Mm-hmm.
And then we did a prequel and moved back in time. And then we moved forward from there. And then these shows have covered 1959 to 1979 with then some flashbacks to like 1879,
wow,
which are really fun. So, yeah,
jeez,
it's been really fun. And then, for me, the most exciting part is that as we move forward, it's a single unit set, which is why theaters love it.
Right.
Small cast. So an audience is really attached then to these characters. How can we find new ways to tell the stories of these same people in the same place?
Right.
And it feels daunting, but then people are complicated and stories are wonderful and unique. And that's always really fun, is to figure out a new way in,
yeah,
and a new viewpoint and a new narrator. And so with now Church Basement Lady 7, we've had a couple workshops. And that first one, I was like, I hope people like it. Because, you know, I go and I think about it a lot, and I take this new attack and I present it.
Yeah.
And we just had another workshop recently, and Kurt, again, my boss, he's like, I think this is going to be a good one. This is really charming. I like it. I can see it. I can see it. And it's great.
Sounds like Kurt.
Like, phew.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You didn't cry.
And I didn't cry.
You didn't cry.
But I did this time around, which is so different. And because it's kind of a collective,
yeah,
and it's this process is very different than a lot of writers. You don't invite so many people into the room.
Right.
But there are a lot of people that invested in this. So there are a lot of people in the room, which is great. But I preemptively wrote a bunch of messages on Post-its, and they said things like, the show isn't done, I know we want it to be funny, some characters aren't fully developed, things can be cut, some of the things that I thought people were going to say.
Right.
And before we even started the reading, I laid them all out on the table, and there were a couple times I would just have to pick up the Post-it and go, yes, the show isn't done yet.
That's great.
Yes, I know, things can be cut. I know we want it to be funny, because it's just, you know, when you invite people in, you have to let them speak.
Yeah.
And sometimes I want to cry, but yeah. I can't cry.
And you don't cry. That's, you've set a precedent. Brian, our engineer over here, actually had an addition to this, which was not in your prepared pamphlet that I sent ahead. Are you Lutheran?
I am Lutheran.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
I figured, but I wasn't sure.
And Scandinavian Lutheran, baptized Lutheran, confirmed Lutheran, so yes.
So you've got a lot of history with this.
Yeah,
sort
and even
of
like when you talk about like my life, I've been doing this for a long time, and then I went and like I said, I lived in New York and I toured, and some of the shows that I did, even like Tony and Tina's Wedding, I played a stripper, and I have some wonderful relatives that we discouraged from coming to the shows.
Yes.
And this was hard for my mom because one of my aunties, she said, well, you raised Greta right. She wouldn't do anything, you know, embarrassing. And then my mom had to sort of say, these are stories and these are people. And it doesn't. So once I started doing Church Basement Ladies, there was a collective sigh. It was my family like, oh, we're so proud. A Lutheran has come home.
That's great. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are certain shows that I tell my mom not to come. Well, she's not in the same state, but if she were to drive from Alabama, I'd
go,
be like,
not this one.
Don't come to, this is not a, you drove up here the wrong time.
Yeah.
So is there a show out of all of these, and not just the Church Basement Ladies, we're not going to keep it to that, but is there a show that you're most proud of?
Yeah, so for those people listening who may not know, the Church Basement Ladies were inspired by the writings and comedy of these two real-life people, Janet Martin and Suzanne Nelson, two wonderful 100% Norwegian Lutheran farm girls who met at Augsburg years ago. And collectively, they've written like 20 books or something, and they had a little comedy act, and they're really funny. Down home, you know, hot flash humor and all of that.
Right.
And so they would tour around and do stuff at churches and things. So Kurt got wind of them and got the rights to all of their material. So when I said we have this huge collective, Janet and Suzanne are part of all of the Church Basement Ladies, and they're always at the table, and they're really funny, and they're a real gift to me because they can help sort of spin it and make it really colloquial and stuff.
Right.
So of that duo, Janet, lives here in Minnesota, and her husband, this is getting on to what I'm proud of, her husband has passed away since I've known her, and her longtime husband, and so a guy named David moved into her basement, and he was a recovering addict and artist. So Janet was grieving from the loss of her husband, this wonderful Scandinavian Lutheran, and David, this recovering addict, was living in her basement. And together, sort of as they were both healing, because Janet's a storyteller and David's an artist, they wrote a coffee table book called Lemonade for the Lawn Boy.
Oh.
And that was based on characters that David had really rich, wealthy Minnetonka women that David had mowed lawns for, and Janet would sort of write their stories. And this was sort of, so they wrote this book. And then I'd gotten to know Janet now because of Church Basement Ladies, and then they asked me to turn it into a musical.
Mm.
And because Janet has changed my life, I mean, I was like, I will do whatever you ask.
Yeah.
What do you need? Do you need a kidney? You changed my life
being
part of this Church Basement Ladies. So so I worked on that, and that then is the thing that I am proud of for a couple reasons. And one is because I did it to honor two amazing, wonderful people that asked me to do it.
Hmm.
And that is, it was such an, like I say, an honor to be asked. And I did them proud, and I was pretty tenacious about it. For a long time, I was just carrying this all on my own.
Yeah.
And then there was a lot of pressure to produce it. So after like 8 years, we had a couple workshops. And so then finally I produced it myself, and we've produced it a couple times, and I've done rewrites and things like that. And I think it has a lot of potential to be something really special.
Sure.
I'm proud of myself for not giving up on it, and I'm proud of the really creative way that I found to tell the story, because there were a lot of people involved throughout the process and a lot of different opinions, and I listen and I've learned how to process that, and I think tell a story that I think has potential to be very powerful, and there were times when I wanted to cry, but I did it in my car, because We were doing this workshop, and Peter Rothstein with Theater La Teda was involved for a while, and wonderful. He really helped. And Sandy Hay, who I'd known from Tony and Tina's Wedding.
Yeah.
So we were having these workshops, and so we would do a reading one day, and then there would be lots of opinions and a lot of thing coming at me. And I can take it for about 3 hours.
Right.
I can take people berating me with their ideas and their opinions about what I've laid out. I can take it for about 3 hours, and then I'm done.
Yeah.
So on that particular day, it was lots of stuff, and then we were done, and I went out to my car and probably sobbed for about 45 minutes, and then I went home and rewrote, and I went back the next day. So, you know, it feels personal. It is personal, but yet you have to just go home and do the rewrites.
But this is... of all the stuff that you've written, this is kind of the most personal.
It
so it does kind
personal.
Of feel a little bit less.
Yeah.
It's not just writing funny jokes for a bunch of Lutheran women, you know, in these shows. Not, you know, devaluing that. But this has so much, there's something below the surface that's got
and
more
And even
of a,
like with the Church Basement Ladies, at the end of the day, I am still working for Kurt.
Right.
So I've even passive-aggressively, which Minnesotans are good at, gone, well, do whatever you want, Kurt. It's your show. Whatever you think is best.
Yeah.
I mean, and then he just, you know, shakes his head at me. So I was second banana.
Yeah.
Even though we would not be at number 7 without me, because I am, as I say, tenacious, and I push, and I make sure, and I was like, we got to get these dates on the calendar. Are we going to do another one? And so I do know that I push and I am creative, and Kurt doesn't have to think about it until he's at the table with me.
Yeah.
Because he sent us an email the other day. I'm doing music and lyrics with Dennis Curley.
Oh, yeah.
And he said, are you guys on track for the reading? And I'm like, yep, we got it. We're good. See you at the reading. So,
oh, wow.
But so even though I have a lot of input, I'm still the second banana. And with Lemonade for the Lawn Boy, I was the banana. And so that is a different kind of emotional investment in something. And it's not dead yet. So as Janet Martin will always say, you know, everything when the time is right. And so, well.
Well, is that brings the question, is that a show one show specifically you'd love to be remembered for? If that was, I mean...
No, I think it is the Church Basement Ladies'
really?
Legacy.
Okay.
Because and there's that thing that they say, what do you want people to say at your funeral? Do they want to talk about what you did or who you are? And I was like, those shows are who I am.
Yeah.
And so I think in terms of the impact for the 3 million people or the 4 million people that have seen those shows, those shows mean so much. And I am honoring my ancestors, my German, Swedish, Norwegian, and Lutheran ancestors who came over on the boat and were farmers.
Mm.
So in that sense, that's the thing I'm most proud of. And, you know, as we started off this conversation, I did get into this business as an actor. But you ask yourself, if I got an award for something, if I won my Tony, what do I want that Tony to be for? And I would, so this is where it becomes interesting. I would love to win a Tony for writing and creating Lemonade for the Lawn Boy, because that is my most creative self.
Sure.
I would love to be on Broadway as an actor, because I think I'm really funny. I'd like people to see how funny I am. And that would be fun to be able to bring joy to people.
Sure.
But I would like to get a Tony for Lemonade for the Lawn Boy. But I want to be remembered, and the thing that people will probably talk about the most is probably Church Basement Ladies.
Mm.
That's the thing. And this happened once. I was on an airplane, and I was sitting next to these people, and it sort of came up that I was part of Church Basement Ladies, and people I'd never seen before, they were like, are you Greta? And I went, why, yes, I am. So I think my legacy will be Church Basement Ladies.
Yeah.
Because that's the thing that... and then who knows what's going to happen? Like, we've had a couple options for sitcoms with it, so that's not dead either.
Okay.
That, you know, we'd love to have a Church Basement Ladies TV show, whatever that is. So that's,
That's just...
A roundabout sort of...
Again, like, there are so many things we could cover. We could just delve into... if you go to GretaGrosch.com, you will not believe the wealth of, well, I advise it. And on the other hand, if you're like me and get envious of other artists and realize you haven't done shit with your life, you look at this and there's a breadth of not only just performer, but also writer and you also do this as a, this is your job type job. You know, that's the great thing about it is there is more to just creating something and putting it out in the universe and just saying, well, I created this versus what you have, which is sort of an, I keep calling it an empire of
well,
like.
Well, jokingly, I say that. Like, literally, like when I'm at, you know, people are like, what are you doing? And I'm like, I'm just working on my empire.
Yeah.
Because it's, there are always, because as you say, it's branched off into other things. Like, I do corporate training and motivational speaking and other comedy at fairs and festivals and stuff. And so it is, it just does keep branching off. And I say the secret to make it is to say yes to everything and keep your expenses low. So as long as you don't have to make decisions about what you do with your life because of money, then you have the freedom to see where the wind blows.
Yeah.
But one of my favorite things to do is to help other people realize their dreams and their potential. And somebody was telling me that they go, I'm thinking about writing my story, writing a one-person show. And I was like, really? My favorite thing to do is to go out with to lunch with people and encourage them to support their dream. So if you really want to do this, we're going out to lunch, and by the end of the lunch, you're going to want to do this because it's really fun to be able to listen to people and to value what it is that they have to say and to encourage them to say it.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times, because I know this, it's like looking in a mirror when we don't value our own selves and our own worth and our own story. So one of my favorite things to do is to help other people see the value of their own story and encourage them to go tell it.
That's so great because there are so many people in this world who have, well, I think everyone in this world has the potential to tell their story. And for whatever reason, low self-esteem or feeling like they can't get the words right in the first draft and all that kind of negativity that goes in your head, it keeps them from actually doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody needs a Greta Grosch in their life to be able to go out to lunch with.
I'm happy to do it.
Yes, at a price. she charges, I think there's a day rate.
No,
you have
it's
to
just
pay.
For the, they have to pay for my lunch. They don't even have to pay for it. Yeah, if they offer to pay, I let them, but I don't even make them offer.
So cool. So I have one last question for you, Greta, and it's one that we ask everybody. Tell me what acting isn't.
This is a three-parter. First, the funny answer is, acting is not a good way to make a living because, you know, it's not consistent work like being a teacher.
Right.
It isn't a contest, by the way, and a lot of people feel like it is a contest. It's not something that everybody's good at. Even some of the people that are doing it and are making money at it, it doesn't mean you're good at it just because you're doing it.
Right.
And I have the opportunity to go and see a lot of theater. I'm an evaluator for this high school musical program with the Hennepin Theater Trust. And I see a lot of high school theater, and there are people who are good at it.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people who are doing it, and they have technique, and they're doing everything right. But there are people who are really good at it. And it gets me thinking about what acting isn't. And acting is not pretending. And a lot of people pretend, and that's valid. Like, oh, look, I'm pretending like there's tea in my cup.
Right.
But acting isn't about pretending. Acting is about believing. And I was thinking about the difference between make-believe and pretending. And pretending is, you know, pretending that there's tea in my cup. And make-believing is believing that there is tea in my cup.
Mm.
So when I talk about there are a lot of people who are actors who aren't acting, they're pretending. And acting isn't pretending. Acting is believing. And that was something really interesting for me to sort of think about how, because pretending is supposing something is the case when it isn't. Mm. And acting is about believing that it's true. So there you go.
That is a great three-part question, or answer rather. I don't think we've gotten that thorough of an answer before. And it's very specific. And yeah. I like how specific it is.
And specifically because, like, pretending is a verb. It's something that you do.
Right.
And make-believe, the word make-believe is a noun, and which means it's something that you are. So there you go. Acting is not pretending.
That's all we got tonight. Thank you so much for being here on The Bazness. It's just been Whew. It's a lot of stuff. I'm sweating. Are you? You're not sweating, are you? I'm sweating. You see me sweating? There are beads of sweat.
I know, because there's. I know, because it's just so inspiring. You just feel. That's great. I know.
Well, thanks everybody for listening to this episode. Do you want to say one more thing before we go?
And thank you for your enthusiasm about me and about my career, because that is. We sometimes, as I mentioned at the beginning, I'm so busy in it that I forget to even look at it.
Yeah.
And for those of you listening, Sam does sort of a storyboard about who he's going to be interviewing. And I'm printing this off, and I am going to have it in my office because it's a good reminder to me about who I am and what I'm doing. And even some of the questions that you've asked me, I'm like, that's a good reminder for me to think about why I'm doing this and what's important to me and what motivates me and who I want to be in the world. So thank you for that.
You're very welcome. I've been told that is a teenage girl's dream journal or a serial killer's ransom note. It's kind of a mishmash of those two things. But yeah, there's also stuff we might not have covered, but we might go back and cover. You just never know. Thank you so much again, Greta. And thank you for listening to The Bazness. We will be back with episode 7, 8. I lost count.
The next episode.
Let's just say it's the next episode. We'll be back with the next episode of The Bazness. I hope you will be too. Thank you very much for listening. The Bazness is made possible thanks to Minnesota Playlist, where you can promote yourself, your job, and your show over at minnesotaplaylist.com. Each and every episode is recorded inside Town Studios at the Good Arts Collective, a member-driven co-op of local artists pooling resources and creating cool art. Learn more at goodartscollective.com. Audio engineering and mixing provided by Brian Lenz. Our Bazness theme was created by Vulpus Vulpus. Hit us up at info@minnesotaplaylist.com. As always, thanks for listening and keep putting your best self out there.